ladies and gentlemen. Sorry about the delay there. Had Skype crash unexpectedly for no reason. Happens all the time, apparently. Thank you, Microsoft. You're the Shiite Muslim. Today on the Vinnie Eastwood Show, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to be talking about one of the main issues affecting virtually every single person around the entire freaking planet. It's called debt. All right? And there's a gosh awful dang bunch of really, really nasty, poisonous, infectious, ruthless spiders that are in the middle of this web that we're all trapped in, so that we're all wrapped up in debt so that the spider can eat at its leisure and liquefy our insides, that's why they call it liquidity, and slurp it all out through your wallet. And my very special guest to illustrate on this is none other than the author of The Web of Debt, Alan Brown. Alan, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Vince.
I hope you're enjoying yourself so far.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, can you please explain what debt actually is in the first place, how it's created, and more to the point, how it's kept going all this time?
Well, the problem with our monetary system is that all of our money, virtually all of our money, is created in the form of debt. It's created by banks when they make loans. Most people think that money is created by the government because you look at the coins and the dollar bills and you see pictures of presidents and queens and prime ministers. But in fact, coins and dollar bills make up only a very small part of the money supply, and even the dollar bills or the banknotes, whatever they're called, are generally issued by the central bank and lent to the government. They're not actually issued by the government itself. And the money that we, the people, trade in is virtually all of it consists of entries, book entries done by banks when they make loans. So if you go to the bank and you take out a mortgage, let's say, they will write your mortgage on one side of their books as an asset to themselves because you have promised to pay that sum over time. And they will write it as a liability to themselves on the other side of their books because they have agreed to cover your checks when you write checks on that account that they've just opened for you. So from their point of view, it all comes out to zero and they haven't really created anything. But those checks that you write that go out into the economy, that becomes our money supply. And that's how the money supply expands and expands. But the problem is that when they create the principal of these loans, they don't create the interest. And so more money is always owed back than was created in the original loan. And there's no place to get that extra money except for somebody to take out more debt. And so it's the nature of a debt-based system that it's like a parasite. It has to continually grow. It grows in this exponential curve in order to find the money to pay principal plus interest when only principal was created in the original loan. So today what we have is everybody's in debt. The people, corporations, governments, they're all in debt. So who are they in debt to? They're not in debt to each other. They're in debt to banks. And the way to fix the system is we really have to fix the banking system by making it sustainable, which would mean that the profits, the interest goes back to the people so that the money's there in order to keep up this cycle of credit creation.
Sustainable, but not in the Agenda 21 sense of the word.
No.
Well, thank goodness for that. Because this is another thing that I've also wondered about, Alan. They're capable of creating all this debt, but people aren't capable of paying it forever. It's like musical chairs. One person is going to end up with the last remaining chair. And that will be the one who creates all the debt at the very central level. Who is that? What is that entity?
That's a good question. Who's behind it all? In fact, you could argue that the system is running itself today, but it was obviously set up, this whole debt-based system. Paper money came into existence pretty much in the 17th century, but even before that, you had bankers would create... they would make more loans than they actually had had gold, and they did this as a bookkeeping entry. So you've had the creation of credit for 1,000 years. Well, in fact, you can go all the way back to biblical times. Yeah, it's kind of hard to say who's behind it or who would wind up with the money in the end. The Bank for International Settlements is the central banker's central bank, and that's in Basel, Switzerland, and that is, they call the shots pretty much, or the Financial Stability Board calls the shots, which is based in the Bank for International Settlements. And that system was originally set up by the Bank of England, which was trying to keep control of their colonies. After the colonies gained political independence, they controlled them by debt. And so they expected to be the central source of all the debt. And then after World War I, when they were unable to fund everything because of war debts themselves, then they spread out this central banking control to the Bank for International Settlements was originally founded by four bankers. It was the Bank of England, the head of the Bank of England, the head of the Central Bank of France, Central Bank of Germany, and the Central Bank of America, the U.S. Federal
this
Reserve.
Is not unlike, this isn't like European royalty, is it, where they're all related?
No. Well, depends. We don't want to get into that.
Well, you see, the reason I ask is because I was aware that after the Battle of Waterloo, was it Mayer L. Rothschild or one of them tipped the stock market over? Basically, he had a good intelligence network, and he knew the outcome of the battle a full day before the royals spies came home to tell them, and he used that knowledge, knowing that the British had won, that it would really boost the stock market. Played out like that, it would like they'd lost, and the stock market started to crash overnight, and he bought it all up for pennies on the dollar. Is that true? Mm-hmm. And then he created the Bank of England or something.
Yeah, that was Nathan Rothschild. Yeah, but the Bank of England was created in 1694. But yeah, that is the legend. It's presumably that happened. And they did become the most powerful family in England and probably the most powerful family in the world. There were five Rothschild brothers. There were 10 kids. Five of them were male, and they headed banks in different parts of Europe. And so that was the original network. And because they were this very tight network, they were able to exchange information very quickly. And so he did get a report on the war faster than anyone else could. And since then, of course, you could argue that the Rothschilds set up this whole system, but they're certainly not the only. There are many other families that are involved. So I'm not sure you can put your finger on
what anyone. What's the word for a system of government where the most powerful families rule? Is that a plutocracy?
I think so. A plutocracy. Yeah. What's an oligarchy? That's when there's several.
I thought oligarchy was simply ruled by money.
Yeah, okay.
Whoever had the money makes the rules, the golden rule.
Yeah.
I believe, in fact, we've got a kind of combination, a plutocracy and an oligarchy, I think, is what we've really got now, is we've got incredibly wealthy people who just happen to be related and just happen to be sociopathic scum who want to control everything.
Yeah, it is hard to believe. I mean, I'm just now, I thought I would sort of break out of my mold and write about GMOs and the Roundup, you know, the chemical that this is actually killing the earth. It's hard to believe that, I mean, what kind of a personality would allow into the earth on which we all live? And yet, that's definitely happening. The chemical in Roundup blocks enzymes from working, which means that it kills every form of plant. So then you need to develop genetically modified plants that are able to survive in Roundup. So they're Roundup resistant plants, and that's what the genetic modification is. But that doesn't mean that you've gotten rid of the Roundup. They actually incorporate it into their roots and into the plant. So when you eat that plant, you are eating pesticide that will block your enzymes, prevent you from digesting your food, which means you're not getting your nutrition, which could well explain why we have an epidemic of obesity and many other diseases that are going up. When, like, we've had the war against cancer since the 1970s, and yet cancer has multiplied by several factors since then, rather than going down. Why is that? There's something in our food, something in our environment, and it's all the mentality of somebody who would want to do that in order to control food sources is, I mean, it hardly seems human, and yet we know it's happening.
Well, thank goodness you don't live in New Zealand. We're allowed 1,000 times more Roundup in our drinking water than allowed under European drinking water standards. And we have the world's highest cancer rate, I think.
Wow.
It's like one in two now.
I'll look into that, yeah. Well, they just increased the allowable rate by a factor of 30.
Oh, of course they did.
Yeah.
Have you noticed that? Well, that's what happens. It's like things get introduced, they make things worse, and instead of going, "Oh, this is making things worse," like a moral person, a person who believes in truth, justice, that kind of thing, would say, "That's really bad. Let's remove that." An amoral person would probably introduce it in the first place. But once you see the results, then they try to cover up the results or increase the levels of allowable toxins and poisons in the environment. And it goes contrary to any form of logic and morality. Now, what I find interesting and also most disturbing, to be frank, is that people go along with it. That's what's worse to me than knowing that there are immoral people out there who have large quantities of power and control, who literally are advancing an agenda to indebt, enslave, and kill humanity to a large degree. There's the good people who sit by and do nothing. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, at the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guest is Ellen Brown. I think it's webofdebt.com. Is that right?
Yep, that'll do. One of many.
We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness and technical difficulties, if you lose your sense of humor, you'll go freaking nuts. Speaking of technical difficulties, our guest, Ellen Brown, has been disconnected, and we don't know when we'll be getting her back, hopefully soon. We're having a conversation over the break, and I don't know if it surprised you, ladies and gentlemen, but it surprised me to hear her talking about glyphosate, Roundup, Monsatan, which in French means my devil. And the thing that she revealed to me over the break is that before actually writing Web of Debt, which is the banking bible kind of thing, if you want to expose the Bank of International Settlements and their enormous scumbaggery, she's actually written like 11 health books. Now, really? And I was quite surprised to hear that, but, you know, today we're probably going to hopefully focus on the banking because I think, but then again, what's more important, banking and exposing its scumbaggery or health? And I think they're both really important. It's kind of like when people talk about the left brain and the right brain, and people say, oh, the left brain's more important or the right brain's more important. No, you idiot. Having your whole brain working is more important.
Mm-hmm.
Just like having a holistic idea of what health is and what banking is at the same time is a hell of a lot more important than just knowing the one. And this is something that Ellen knows quite a lot about. Yeah, and I hear that you're back. Are you able to turn your webcam on there?
I'm back.
Okay,
good.
Do you
see me? Do you hear me?
I can hear you, but I cannot see you just see yet.
Yep, you just reset the
camera. Should be now. Yeah. Hmm. All right. Well, in the meantime, when we think about banking, what I find interesting is that often the leaders of countries are either bankers themselves or heavily financed by bankers. And I found that very startling and kind of scary, but also pretty obvious, and it makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? Because if you're going to make policy to shaft a country, who better to have as your president than a banker? You know, it's pretty straightforward, I would have thought.
Well, in Europe right now, we have bankers that are heading the system that were not elected as presidents. I mean, the head of Greece. Well, sorry, I'll take that back. But anyway, we have
is this Mr. Papademos in Greece
controlling the economic system? Yeah. And I mean, the whole European system simply is not sustainable because the ECB, it's set up so that only banks can get money from the ECB. The governments themselves cannot borrow from the ECB, which is the central bank of Europe. And so the governments have to borrow from the banks, which then borrow from the ECB. So the banker's rates, the good deal that you get as a banker only goes to the bankers, and then they pass it on to the governments at much, much higher rates. Unlike in the U.S., where at least our central bank can fund the government. I mean, it can buy government bonds, which is what they are doing with quantitative easing, which many people think is controversial or think is inflating the system, but it's not actually. It's just an asset swap where they're buying up bonds, and so the banks that used to have bonds on their books now have dollars on their books, and the Federal Reserve has the bonds. But the difference is that when the Federal Reserve gets the bonds, they rebate the interest to the government. So effectively, our government, to the extent that the Federal Reserve is holding our government's bonds, our government is borrowing interest-free from its own central bank, which is a good thing. That's what Canada did from 1939 to 1974. And during that time, they funded their development all across the country. They funded their health, set up their healthcare system, and that's how they funded it. And it wasn't in the 1970s, they switched over to borrowing on the open market, borrowing from banks and other lenders, which meant they were borrowing at a much higher interest rate. Or when they were borrowing from themselves, they were effectively borrowing interest-free. And then in fact, you're in Australia. Let's see, the Commonwealth Bank of Australia. I'm in New Zealand. I'm sorry, okay.
The Reserve Bank of New Zealand.
So the Reserve Bank of New Zealand in the 1930s did the same thing. It was set up as a central bank that was supposed to be privately owned, like the U.S. Federal Reserve is privately owned. And the Social Credit Party got in, or a Money Reform Party got in, and took it over and used it as an instrument of social credit. So what they did was just issue credit, the credit of the government through the central bank. And one thing they did was set up this low-cost housing, for public housing. And they built it with public credit, and then the rent from this housing paid off the loan. Just that was the same way that Roosevelt funded the whole New Deal, where you advance credit for things that are productive enterprises, things like roads and dams and farms and libraries and post offices and universities, things where the loan was then paid back, and you wound up with infrastructure. And it was basically the taxpayers didn't have to pay anything. But the trick is you have to be able to extend the credit in the first place. So anyway, that's what a central bank should do, and that's what New Zealand has done, Australia has done historically. Australia was the best, the most remarkable of the models. In 1912, what the U.S. Federal Reserve was set up in 1913, but at that period in 1912, there had been a global banking crisis, and the Australians felt that the banks had failed and that the government needed to take over this function. And so they set up their own publicly owned central bank. And then the man who headed it, who was a banker and knew that banks just issued credit from nothing, that knew that they got the money just as accounting entries, he just started issuing credit for all sorts of development across the country and for funding Australia's participation in World War One. So his downfall was when he went to London and bragged about the fact that they didn't need to borrow anymore. They no longer needed to borrow from the City of London, that anything the Australians wanted they could have. They just had to issue the credit, and then if they made prudent loans, the credit would pay for itself over time. And so he passed away suddenly after that of a heart attack at a relatively young age, 63. And after that, they changed the system where they set up this central bank system where the central bank would issue the money and lend it to the government. And now they got so excited about this system, they decided they would do that globally. And that's what we have today, is this global central banking system controlled by Basel, by the Financial Stability Board at the Bank for International Settlements, yeah, in Basel, which stemmed originally from the Bank of England or from the City of London.
So not only is there connections between the setting ups of all banks, I was just starting to think now, how many people, is there a web page somewhere where somebody has listed all the public figures that have stood up against private central money lending, debt-based banking, and how many of them have been killed over time?
Not to my knowledge, but I could name a few. You probably can too.
I mean, the first one that comes to mind is like Jesus. he threw the money changers out of the temple. Okay. Ah, crucifixion.
Yeah, good point.
Crucifixion? Yes, good. Line on the left, grab a cross, one cross each. Mm-hmm. If that does actually happen, whoa, does that mean bankers need to be executed, right? Because George Carlin actually said this in one of his comedy routines, and I think it bears repeating, that there are some people out there who want to legalize the death penalty for drug dealers. And he says this is a waste of time because drug dealers aren't afraid to die. They kill each other by the hundreds every day. If you want to stop the drug money, why not execute the bankers who launder it? White, middle-class, Republican bankers,
on pay-per-view. Well, it's true. It would, it'd be satisfying to see, everybody wants to see the crooks go to jail, but you have to fix the system, or it's like ants or termites or whatever. I mean, cockroaches, you get rid of one, and five more fill in that, are right behind them. And until you plug the holes where they come in. So it seems to me that our ultimate goal has to be to restructure the system. There will always be people ready to take advantage of opportunities. Like the whole Wall Street syndrome, the movie Wall Street was set up to discourage young people from going into the trading business. And in fact, what it did was everybody then wanted to be a trader. They like this idea of cheating the system.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think it's when you give people the opportunity for great rewards with bugger all work, they jump on the opportunity, don't they? I think that's why government employs so many people. And Texas, so many others.
Yeah. Well, that's another thing. You could eliminate taxes. You could entirely eliminate taxes. They did it in colonial America, in Pennsylvania, by if the government ran the banks. I actually ran the figures on this for, well, what they did in Pennsylvania was the government had the printing press. It printed its own paper money. But instead of just printing and printing and printing, which did tend to hyperinflate the system, you know, some other colonies got into inflation problems. But in Pennsylvania, what they did was they printed money and lent it to the farmers. And then the money would come back with principal plus 5% interest. But then they spent some extra money into the for roads and bridges and whatever their budget was. So there would be enough money out there to pay principal and interest. So it would all come back to the government as principal and interest. So this is the public banking model where it's sustainable. Instead of having to take out more and more debt to pay the interest, the interest is out there and it can come back. And so during that period, they paid no taxes because the money made by the bank itself was sufficient to cover taxes. And had no government debt, and they didn't have inflation. So it was a totally sustainable.
Sorry? There's been suggestions that a good idea is to both outlaw charging interest and outlaw taxes. Unapportioned taxes, rather, income tax specifically.
Right. You could eliminate income taxes. That's right. You might not be able to eliminate all taxes. But the way I figured it a few years ago, I think there was something $400 billion that we pay in taxes. I was calculating the whole budget, which... Okay, so I think it was $1.2 trillion was taxes, $400 billion was interest on the federal debt. And then the banks themselves made $700 billion in interest. So if you add those two things together, if you didn't have to pay interest on your debt because you own the bank, and if you were the bank and therefore you got the interest that everybody else paid on their loans, that would be sufficient to cover the entire income tax bill. So you could wipe out income taxes that way. I personally am not opposed to interest if the bank is we the people. In other words, interest is, you actually need interest for a sustainable system because some people won't pay back their loans. Even in the best intention people, there will be defaults. And so if you're going to balance your books, if that's a requirement that you balance your books, and if the default rate, in the best of times, the default rate, I think, is about 4%. So you would need to charge 4% interest just to cover that. And let's say you throw in a little more for your... Well, anyway, 4% interest would do it. But also, it seems to me there's a problem. If you're going to give interest-free loans to individuals, everybody will say, well, I have this brilliant idea. If I just had $1 million, I'd pay you back in a year. You know, lend me $1 million, I'll do my brilliant idea, and I'll pay you back with my profits. And then you almost make it, but you don't. And you say, well, I'll do it next year. You know, roll over my loan, and I'll do it next year. What incentive do you have to ever pay it off? You'll just keep rolling over the loan. Unless there is some interest, some reason to make it your benefit to pay it off.
All right. Well, let's continue this one over the break because I think it is very interesting indeed. Pun intended. We'll be right back. Ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's the lighter side of genocide because in a world so full of chaos and madness and scumbaggery banksters, if you lose your sense of humour, you'll go friggin' nuts. And my very special guest is Ellen Brown. She's an author. Webofdebt.com is one of her websites. Something tells me you've got like umpteen others. Would you care to, give yourself a shameless plug?
Okay. Well, my latest book is called The Public Bank Solution, which is, so Web of Debt was the problem, which is the banking system. The solution is a better banking system, which would be one that's publicly owned, that returns the profits to the public, returns the interest, that has control of where credit is directed, so credit can go where in the sectors of the economy where it's needed. So that website is publicbanksolution.com. And then my blog is at ellenbrown.com, and it's got over 200 articles on it, on this subject. And I guess that's enough. Web of Debt. Yeah.
All right. Fair enough.
I also have a publishing company.
The public banking system has been opposed by many sides, and usually by people with no information who just choose to demonize people who promote this kind of banking system, which historically does actually work and work very well, and as you've said, is sustainable. One of the critiques that I've seen is they call it funny money. And I say, well, if public banking money is funny money, what we've got now is frickin' hilarious.
Well, public banking is not about changing the issue of the money. I mean, we're talking about local public banks. You could have central public banks, of course, that many central banks are technically owned by the government. For example, the Bank of England is owned by the government, but it's still controlled privately. I mean, it caters to the banks. Or the Federal Reserve is the obvious example. It is literally privately owned. There are 12 branches of the Federal Reserve System. All of them are 100% owned. The stock of the branches, they're incorporated. The stock of the branches is 100% owned by the banks in their districts. And they, of course, pull the strings. And the Federal Reserve Act itself is set up to serve the banks. In fact, when Ben Bernanke was doing quantitative easing, after he did the first quantitative easing, and then they were thinking about what to do on the second round of quantitative easing, and it was suggested that why didn't he issue money and lend it very cheaply to state and local governments, because they were the ones that had been devastated by this whole banking crisis, and it wasn't their fault. I mean, they had lost their tax base because of this banking crisis, which was the fault of Wall Street. So why not give them these bankers' rates, you know, these very low interest rates? And Ben Bernanke said, well, it's not in his mandate. That's not in the Federal Reserve Act. He is not allowed to make loans to state and local governments. And it's the same way with the ECB. It is not allowed, according to the Maastricht Treaty, to make loans directly to governments.
So basically, if you're a private central bank, it's illegal to actually help the government that you're supposed to be providing the money for.
Right. And at one time, central banks actually belonged to the governments and they served the governments. And that was a better system. I mean, you could corrupt any system. Well, I just now wrote about Costa Rica, which I don't think I wasn't even aware of it myself until somebody wrote to me who lives in Costa Rica. And he said they have this wonderful banking system. It's 80% publicly owned banks. The people refuse to give up their publicly owned banks, even though the IMF has tried very hard to privatize them. The whole system went, in 1949, there was a big revolution. And before that, they were the poorest, they were the poorest country around. And so they didn't have resources. They didn't really have anything. And they came around to now they were rated as the number one on the happiness index by, I forget who it is who does his ratings, but anyway, quality of life is very high in Costa Rica. And what they did was they turned a number of major industries into publicly owned industries. So they were making money for the people with these industries. These are like infrastructure, the type of industries that should be commonly owned, or should, you know, the profits should go back to the people, and they do. Telecommunications, they refuse to give that up. Social Security, pension funds, those are all in the public sector. And the public sector controls banks and or owns the banks. And so they're very safe for the people. In the rest of Central America, the banks keep failing, and then people lose their money when the banks fail. So that's why the people don't want to give up these public banks, which are very safe. They're protected by the government because they are the government. And they direct credit for 50 years now. They've been directing credit to the sectors that need it. So they've used that credit to build infrastructure, et cetera. And it's worked really well. So the man that wrote to me about that, he keeps telling me more and more about the system. He said that when people ask him, well, why do you think this worked so much better in Costa Rica than it did in Eastern Europe? Well, for one thing, he thinks it probably did work better in Eastern Europe than we've been led to believe or we're allowed to know. But that he thought that the difference was that in Costa Rica, it's a very democratic, transparent, accountable system. I mean, it's, if you have a corrupt government, of course, you can corrupt anything, including your banks. But if you have an accountable system where everybody can see what's going on, and we've now come to that stage where, because of the internet, it's quite possible that you could put your whole banking system on the internet, and people could see, like the Bank of North Dakota, which is publicly owned, they could see exactly what's going on, what kind of loans are being made, who they're being made to. So it would be fully accountable, fully transparent in a democratic system. Then it works really well.
It would allow a lot of public watchdogs the information they need in order to indeed force accountability by exposing any type of corruption that they might find. I remember I talked to the late Bob Chapman a number of years ago, and I asked him, is it possible to get rid of corruption, like entirely, forever? He says, no, it's not possible to get rid of corruption. It is possible to get it back, but it's a perennial problem. It's like grass. You have to keep mowing it down.
Yeah, but I just wonder, I mean, it seems to me that we are sort of, the internet has changed so many things. For example, the media can't control us anymore because we have our own media, so we can find out what's going on. And then this whole spying thing, I mean, it is creepy that they can know everything about you, but just imagine it, that we could actually turn that for good, it seems to me, possibly, in the sense that if you know that there's nowhere to hide, then you'll do the right thing, because why not? You might
what
as well.
What have you got to lose?
Yeah. It's just way too tempting to cheat when it's easy to cheat. But if it's not easy to cheat, then you'll play by the rules. Why not?
Yeah, I think so, because that's how corruption works, I think. People would do corrupt things if they can't get away with them.
It's like cockroaches. You get rid of all the places to hide and you won't have cockroaches.
Well, exactly. But, of course, you've got to remain eternally vigilant. And I think this is one of the what the Founding Fathers said, is that that's the price of freedom, is you've got to eternally live in vigilance to for your true enemy's return.
Yeah, true.
Mm. You know, freedom isn't free, and that's what people don't really get, because it's been handed to them on a silver platter all their lives. Hello, you've got freedom of speech, you've got freedom of this, that, and the other, but you don't actually have any of those rights that they say to you, because they just keep getting taken away by the corrupt system, right? You only actually have three rights, and this was told to me by a police prosecuting sergeant, 15 years in the New Zealand police. Put up, shut up, or pay up. Those are the only three rights guaranteed to you by the law and the legal system. Everything else, you have to fight and or die for.
Yeah, that's pretty scary. But I do think that one reason people are apathetic is they really don't feel they have any power. That, for example, nobody wants these wars that are going on in the Middle East. The public doesn't want them. But what can we do about it? They're not listening to us. We can call our Congress people. They don't listen. No matter what, we don't have the big law. It's the big lobbies that control everything. They're not listening to we the people. But I think that's the problem we have to overcome, is we have the numbers. If we could get organized, we need a united front of a movement to change things. And the problem there is that there are many money, I mean, even just in reforming money, and there are lots of things that need reform, but just say in banking, we have different theories just on that. And so people can't, or, we're at the stage now where we're sort of battling it out among ourselves about what is the best system to have. You could have a violent revolution, as many countries have had, but what they tend to lead to is military dictatorships, because everybody knows we don't like the current system, but there's no agreement on what we want to replace it with. So I think in order to do this sanely, civilly, and to come out with something better, we need to have a plan that we agree on before we attempt to change the system.
I completely agree. And there's a new age philosophy that if it's negative, I don't want to look at it. You know, if it's bad, I don't want to look at it. I want to ignore it. And what you resist persists. And it's the direct opposite to reality, because if you don't look at what the actual problem is openly, honestly, and you accept the problem for what it is, how in the frack are you ever going to propose a solution that actually solves those problems if you have no idea what the problems themselves actually are because you're too afraid to look at them?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Be brave, ladies and gentlemen, and mighty forces will come to your aid. Alan Brown from webofdebt.com, thank you very much for your time today, love.
Thank you.
All right. We'll be back next segment, ladies and gentlemen, with Dr. Richard Alan Miller. Stay tuned. Ladies and gentlemen, to the show that's about being accidentally slapped in the eye by your own pair of headphones, it's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com 5 days a week. And my illustrious, very special guest right now is Dr. Richard Alan Miller. Welcome to the show.
Boy, I love your panache. I love it all. Your music is excellent, and I'm fussy. So
really?
Thank you for, I enjoyed your song. I really appreciated it a lot because I'm actually really into music. That's what I do. As a volunteer, I work at the Brit, and I got to meet people like Mark Knopfler. He liked my hat. And, you know, so I'm fussy about my music. And you were really actually very good.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. Well, are you talking about the happy birthday song?
Happy birthday. Yes, I am. That's how I chose to contact you. You sent that to me. I watched it. I went, wow, that was really good. I actually really enjoyed it. So.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, if you want to see that happy birthday song as well, one thing I really want to see is, because it's way better than the actual normal happy birthday song, I thought it would be really awesome to be able to actually see a crowd singing that to somebody on their birthday, you know, while they're blowing out candles and stuff. That would be great. So if you search happy birthday Parky Hachis, ladies and gentlemen, P-A-K-E-H-I, H-A-C-H-I-S, like a Pākehā and a mariachi, you'll be able to see that happy birthday song by Vinnie Eastwood and Mikhail Pierce there, you know. It'll be good. Anyway, speaking of which, let's get down to business, because I wanted to talk with you about holographics. You know much about holographics?
Well, I'm credited for writing the holographic concept of reality. I wrote that maybe 10 years before Carl Pribram or John Boehm did. And the reason I wasn't in Michael Talbot's book was all my work was classified. It's the way it works, man. You know, that's the way it is downtown. And I remember when, holonomic, give me a break. if you want a one-liner on it, it's a way of looking at the universe that offers solutions that a quantum universe will not. Quantum universe, for example, has Heisenberg. Okay, so here we are, that the more you know about one thing, the less you know about something else. How does that work for a physicist? You know, I mean, we would really like to know a little more about things, not less, because we know more about something else. That's crazy. So, basically, a quantum universe deals with space and time as your primary measuring, you know, the length of time or space, whereas a holographic system deals with information. And as we're now discovering, parts of our anatomy, our body, our physics of biology, actually are outside space and time. That was one of the protocols I developed for Navy SEALs. When I was a SEAL, we wanted to learn how to be intuitive, how to think with our gut. And, you know, when you flip a coin and you call it, you know, what is it? You know, basically, you're dealing with statistical inference and the rational brain, which basically is here. This thing here is to make sure that your beliefs are correct. I wouldn't have seen it if I hadn't believed it. It's not real. You're making it all up. It's I can, you know, prove that. And so a holographic universe then deals more in terms of information and resolution of information. In other words, you got physical and emotional and intellectual and archetypal. In fact, there are 8 different ways information are organized in Leary's. I use Timothy Leary, but there's a lot in memes. The concept of how we structure or memorize or store certain kinds of information. And really, your gut, for example, will allow you to be outside space and time. You can make decisions that are like 99.9975% probable for 3 sigma. How do you do that without, you know? So the gut, which is your first brain, is actually in some ways connected with a universe that has nothing to do with space or time. It has to do with your purpose. And so if you're getting the idea, and what you're trying to do is tap into the higher senses of consciousness. And in order to do that, it's not about space or time. And so you construct a universe that would be more holographic in nature. And basically, a hologram is where you have n dimensions of information compacted into n minus 1 dimensions. It's an abbreviation system of the way information folds into or out of itself. And with that explanation, it would then draw that emotions, EQ, is more important than IQ. And so, you know, being aware, you know, that's what your music does. It brings out another level of experience in things. And it's all connected. But the hologram is the way it closes in or implodes out on itself with information. There you go.
Well, I was watching a movie called Robot and Frank. And Frank was a retired thief, and he lives on his own. He's kind of old now. And his son buys him a robot. There's like a little robot butler to do all his work and everything. And what he does is he trains the robot how to steal things so that he can go back out and start stealing again. And what was very interesting is towards the end of the film, he realized that the robot's memory banks would be able to be tapped into by the authorities, and they'd be able to have evidence that he committed all these crimes. And so he said, well, why don't we try and delete those specific memories? And he says, I can't do that. All my memories are stored on a hologram, so you can't actually ever delete them. You can only delete the quality of the recording a little.
The quality. Now, that's an interesting metaphor. There you go. Quality. Yeah.
I like. What do you make of that?
Well, that's there is a really neat science fiction movie out called Delete. You know, and it's about a computer that deletes mankind, but you know, Control Alt Delete. But, you know, system reboot. I like these concepts. That's why it's called science fiction, you know, where you take a concept of science and you make a space opera or something out of it, where you show in metaphor, you know, the principle of living on a neutron star, for example. What would life be like as a crystal that could only grow in one direction because of gravity? That's Robert Forward. There's a lot of really good science fiction writers like that. Who wrote that, by the way? What was that called again?
I don't know. I never heard of it.
No, your science fiction you were talking about. The idea of the guy with this little robot.
I'm not sure who wrote it. It was a movie.
Yeah, cool. I haven't seen it. I like science fiction movies. I usually get an... I pop it in here on my arm and feed it in.
Well, see, the way I was looking at holographics, or at least my understanding of it, maybe you can enlighten me somewhat if I'm wrong, but it's about a repetition of repeating patterns, you know, like a fractal.
Yeah. The math that's used is fractal math, which is a generator, okay? And there are several kinds. There's Mandelbrot, Julian May, but they're like, when you have something that's this size, the next generator is this size. It's not this size. It's not that size. It's, you know, there's a relationship of one size to the next, like your Fibonacci thing. It'll scroll out and repeat itself going into or out of itself. And basically, that has to do with the structure of a specific molecule, like dimethyltryptamine, that there's eight of them, neurotransmitters, that would predict how information would fold into or out of itself mathematically. And what you're talking about are fractals. And so the resolution has to do with where you start your start point. You start your point here. The next resolution is going to be here. It's not going to be up here. It's not going to be down here. It's going to be right here. And if you're here, then it'll be here. In other words, there's a relationship of one thing to another.
Kind of like how prime numbers work, sort of thing.
Yeah. There's a relationship. It's numeronomy is what that field of physics is called. Has to do with the nature of different and predicated on the base system that you're working with. You know, prime numbers and things like that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you said that you literally kind of wrote the book on holographics, but you couldn't tell anybody what it is because it was classified, is it still classified? Can you not talk about it?
No, I'm old. That's all I know. I wish that. Yeah, that'd be cool. No. When I came out of undergraduate school, I went to work for Old Man DuPont in Wilmington, Delaware, and they had me at the experimental research station. You know, there I was. And I'm walking down the hall, going to my lab, and I looked in this one laboratory, the door was open, and there was a three-dimensional color TV, and that's where I met Gaber. I met the man that invented or constructed the word hologram. And he had a three-dimensional color TV. Saw it. Where is that TV now? I mean, I saw it in 1966. 1967, so that means that they have, in many ways now, started to repress certain kinds of technology. But I saw that, and when I did, I was struck with the idea that man was basically a hologram of a three-dimensional structure called the DNA. That paper was called Embryonic Holography. And basically, I suggested that the DNA was a three-dimensional hologram of who man was, who man is, and who man will be. In other words, it contained a time element in terms of the unfoldment of going from one dimensional set to another. So I then suggested, oh, well, maybe all we are is a waveform in space. And everybody thought that was real weird. But it allowed us to do the initial grasping of how mind control might work using microwave. Now, this is back in the 70s, And I sent you that paper. I don't know if it came across to you yet or not. I sent you synthetic telepathy. Enjoy that. That was stuff I did back 40 years ago. And today, I'm writing about the new dimensions of it. And they have really gone over the edge, I have to tell you, Vinny. The stuff is they're weaponizing our foods. They're turning them into weapons. I don't know. You're in Australia?
No, New Zealand. Why is it that Americans always think New Zealanders are from Australia? It's unbelievably frustrating.
I didn't know which country you were from. I didn't know.
I know. It's an American geography thing, you know.
Well, your singing certainly didn't tell me which country you were from. It was excellent, by the way. You're actually...
In fact, an article came out in New Zealand, I think in 2003, showing that all New Zealand's most popular musicians and bands all sing with American accents.
Oh, well, what about Yathu Yindi? Hey, listen, man, I've been there. I have a bunch of Aborigines up on stage doing rock and roll. I love it, man. Australia and New Zealand, they're quite different. You're closer to Antarctica and probably have more of that structured water coming out of the Antarctic Ocean. You don't know about that, do you?
No, not really.
They're mining deuterium in and around New Zealand. There's a big deposit
of it. In fact, there was some... funny you should mention that. I just received a document last night of the minister for, I think he was the earthquake recovery minister and as well as a minister for natural resources or something like that, Jerry Brownlee.
Minister of money.
Minister of extracting natural resources and giving it to foreign banks and private military contractors. But he said that there's something like, $4 trillion plus worth of those rare elements locked in New Zealand soil, these things that are used for fiber optic cables, things that are used for specialized military weapons and advanced technologies that we've got really rich mineral deposits that they want to start extracting. And there was this this coal mine that we had called Pike River Mine. Now, at the time, Pike River Mine's symbol, by the way, is a pyramid, of course.
Of course it is.
And all the miners that went down into the mine all got blown up and died. And the first cop on the scene was surprised that he wasn't the first one on the scene. He was surprised to find the military was already there, a demolition crew. And what was interesting at the time is just before this Pike River Mine explosion, the government had been telling the people why it's so important that instead of doing underground mining, that we do big open cast mining in all of our national parks where all of these things are, because it's cheaper and more efficient. This is how it works, isn't it?
It's all about greed. And I would be remiss if I didn't say something about Fukushima. And you're right there in the middle of it. And I am preparing a brief, a white paper for Kerry Cassidy. And I'll share it with you when I get it finished, even before I do her show. It's Fukushima in the military. I'm still military, as you may know. I'm not like high up anymore, but I'm old and grumpy. But they gave me a position, you know, to manage a bunker for the military. And we use a type of algorithm. It's a form of Clifford algebra that monitors the chatter on the internet and will then accurately predict the future based on the buzz that's going on with keywords and things. This is above.
Is that similar to Cliff High's web bot program?
Similar. We're using Ben Gerstle's material. We're using a slightly different form of algorithm. They're all very similar. You know, they're algebraic. Okay. Well, they're algorithms that, and it would suggest that this is similar.
Well, hold on. We'll actually continue this after the break. Dr. Richard Alan Miller is my guest. Ladies and gentlemen, back in just a few minutes, folks. Don't you go anywhere.
Come gather round, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the water accepted that soon you'll get drenched to the bone.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the show that's all about getting irradiated. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from New Zealand, the only first world nation to be completely surrounded by a radiated ocean. You got to love that shit, right, Muslim? No, it's not the only one. We're all surrounded by it now, baby. You know, I'm just wondering, how do you deal with the reality of Fukushima? You know, I was just there are some people out there who deny that it's even a problem. Who, like, I'll show them the screenshots of NOAA and other organizations and so on and so forth, satellite imagery of the radiation plumes that are all around the entire Pacific Ocean. And they go, no, that's not real. You probably made it up on a computer or something like that. It's like, dude, are you freaking insane? Are you totally crazy?
The standard stock response is, don't worry, we'll make more. There's too many people in the world anyway, right? Mr. Bill! Oh. You know, really. It's plausible deniability. Good luck with that.
It doesn't sound very plausible.
Fukushima is now in a serious situation. It wasn't as bad as it has become. It is becoming worse. The kinds of management and disclosure that's coming out of there is inadequate. It's not working right. Basically, over the last 50 years, your primary organized crime units, mafias in different countries, took over garbage disposal and waste control. You know, they run all the garbage trucks in the United States anyway.
For the easy disposal of bodies, right?
Well, it's going to be more about disposal of garbage. Like Bendix would bury batteries in a community that then leukemia started showing up. And there'd be class action suits about the fact that they weren't taking care of the garbage. Now, what's happening right now is that France sells their nuclear waste to Germany, and Germany disposes of it in South Africa. And it's the deaths that are coming in there. You can watch the kinds of thyroid and other kinds of cancers that are developing in Africa. And it becomes very clear that some of the primary people that we respect, like Kofi Annan and some of the other Kofi Annan, are under the tank of disposal of waste materials like TV screens and things like that. These minerals came out of Africa in the first place, you know, to make the crystals and the cell phones. In the United States right now, there's 1.57 cell phones per person. Now, that's a lot of chips that are actually and they're basically toxic. And when they wear out and they dispose, because that's what they make these little tiny devices on, so that you can throw them away and they'll be like Dorito corn chips. They'll make more of them. You know, it's crazy. Oh, and this one does, it scratches my back. You know, it's got apps that scratch my back or whatever. It's crazy. The grid itself, right now we are in a lockdown in FEMA Region 3 in the United States. That's happening right now, where they're doing an experimental off the grid, where Safeway stores and Walmart are on their own grids. It's a, you know, emergency response thing that FEMA's been setting up. That's where all those weapons and body bags and everything else that you've been reading in the media went for, you know, to do this drill.
Apparently, those are the only things that would survive a nuclear holocaust, is cockroaches and Walmart.
No, even they don't make it. Actually, if it's plutonium and you're a bacterium 2 miles down in a lava tube, you're not going to survive. That's how invasive that is. So, you know, it's not, you know, they're basically suggesting the infobots, the types like Cliff High and some of these other things that we in the military use, they're all suggesting that we're getting right down to the edge of being probably the worst event in human history, other than possibly Atlantis. and you're about to watch an Atlantis or Greece in rich culture, the Shogun is going to disappear forever. And it will be gone from history, just like Atlantis will be. Japan itself, sitting on a precipice, there's nothing below it. You know, an 8.4, and it's gone. It's history. And what about reactor 4 with all those plutonium rods up about 40 feet high? How's that work? Running by the Yakuza? That's crazy. The whole thing is nuts. And while I don't have ultimate solutions, I am being asked to talk more about ascension and how to change the movie. You know, using the non-local mind. That's the book I'm now writing. I have other books out right now. The Power Tools were probably, well, the talks I'm doing in Mexico and other places like that, and these big consciousness conferences I'm doing now, basically they're around how to defend yourself against weaponization of epigenetics. You know, wheat is a weapon now. It's not even about GMOs. What they're doing is they're altering a gene in wheat to activate a bacteria in your gut that you got from a cat when it purred in your face. It's T. gondii. It's inert, and the gene in wheat activates it. And Science Digest likes to refer to that bacteria as little mind benders. They turn into a Walmart shopper. What they're after now, well, it's, oh yeah, you got the idea anyway. Everybody over here is obese. Everybody's sick. I have started to eat from my garden. I started a garden last year. This year I learned how to can. Next year I will learn how to eat out of my cupboards. What I'm trying to say is it's time for everybody to get off the couch and start practicing one step at a time towards sovereignty, and the grid is going to collapse. We're right now in the middle of some major X1 band coronal mass discharges from the sun. You can go to Suspicious Observer. There they are. Boom, boom. And that's what caused Fukushima in the first place. And if Fukushima has a second, I don't know, tsunami from a plate shift in the out in the ocean, like they almost did again a couple days ago, I don't even want to think about what's going to happen to Earth. Because if any of those plutonium rods hit each other, we have a nuclear explosion, and that's different. That's what happened in Reactor 3. They said it was hydrogen, and now they're proving that it was actually a nuclear explosion that blew off Reactor 3. And what they're doing now is removing as much as 5 feet of topsoil from the area because it's all laden with plutonium. Yeah, welcome to the new world. And
what the hell are you going to do without 5 feet of topsoil to grow your gosh dang crops in, man?
Where are you going to do it? Well, there's the sun. You can shoot it into the sun. You can do the original way of doing it, where you melt it in with glass and you bury it. That's you, and usually that's the cheapest way they do it. They marry it to glass and they bury it, and then it's down there for a billion years. The thing is, it took the Earth more than a million years to bring those radioactive unstable isotopes back into true. And so what we're doing now with our uranium and now plutonium is making huge stockpiles of a toxin that it took the Earth millions of years to break down and make stable. It's crazy. That technology is wrong. I think the first thing that should happen is that the switch be turned off, and then all the budgets on nuclear energy be oriented toward remediation and changing and cleanup. Africa is probably the first place you're going to need to start on that. That's what they've been doing in Africa.
Can I ask, what are we going to do about it? What are we going to do about the Pacific? Because there's another problem in the Pacific, and I just want to kind of mention it first before we go into this. There's a massive plastic soup in the Pacific.
Several times
the size of the state of Texas, just floating garbage, a continent virtually. And a couple of people have actually come up with this really ingenious idea of this boat, kind of like a fishing trawler. It has two massive... sucks it all up and cleans the ocean as it does it without killing any of the fish or anything. Now, I was just wondering, are there any suppressed technologies that clean up radiation that's in water?
Well, they're talking about it. There's all these different, you know, the Hutchinson effect, John Hutchinson. Yeah, I've seen a lot of this.
In fact, I met a man a year ago who actually met John Hutchinson in the desert, and he showed him his devices and everything, and he thought it was really amazing. Like he had one of those big long horseshoe files.
John. Yeah, he lives here in Oregon. He's been here to my home for dinner. Using radar to create harmonics in a microwave band that would destabilize isotopes is kind of a little far-fetched. Even Bearden might have some problems with the scalar waves. Now, with that said, there are technologies I don't know anything about, zero-point energy crap. I haven't seen anything that's viable, okay, as a physicist. I'm like, I don't see anything new over the horizon. I'm wondering why. You know, that's a real... I mean, if I were, you know, back in the day, I'd be on that like stink on shit. I mean, that's the move of the century right now. This has got to be... Right now, and the removal of those rods on Reactor 4 is as scary as the Cuban Missile Crisis was. That's how dangerous it's going to be. They make
the
one...
The difference being, of course, that the Cuban Missile Crisis, everybody knew about it at the time and was really freaking out and wanted to do something about it. Fukushima, virtually blackout.
Oh, there's 1,500 rods that they have to remove, and if one of it's like playing pickup sticks. You throw them up in the air, and they all fall down in a clack, and then you have to pick one stick up at a time without anything else moving. And they got 1,500 of them to do that. And if any of them touch each other, New Zealand's gone first.
And how's New Zealand gone first if it happens in Japan?
It's going to take you out before it took out, you know, just like on the beach, that movie with David Niven driving over the edge. Listen, the whole thing is risky. And what they're having to do it, and they have concerns. And now the rods are 40 feet up in the air in these towers that are not tsunami proof. And then they postponed the testing. They stopped the removal with those tornadoes that went through. You know, they decided maybe they shouldn't do it during that period. Now they're going to resume it this week. Good luck. That's how you are. And that's what I meant about there's no oversight. Nobody's monitoring these people that are doing TEPCO is absolutely lying. So, you know, where are we? You know, besides greed and doom. Now, there is other possibilities. How far out do you want to go?
As far out as it goes.
Well, here we go
as
then.
As usual.
Supposing that I'm not real, I'm just a wise old man somehow having dialogue with your consciousness, that you're hallucinating that badly, okay? That your daughter isn't really your daughter, it's a younger woman having dialogue with your consciousness. That's Jungian psychotherapy. And at the moment of your death, it won't matter because that's when time stops. There's a movie that you can have your listeners check out called Astral City. It's in Portuguese, so you have to do an English subtitle, you know, captions, whatever you want to do. And it's about a guy, doctor, watching himself die on the operating table, and then when he dies, what happens next? And basically, the physical plane in the movie is where you go to be sick spiritually. That your experience of reality, you know, time and holograms and all the rest of that, how it all works, right, is your illness of fever. you're that sick. And that when you wake up, you go back to the future, and they got these cool beds, and they float, and everybody heals with their hands, and, you know, it's a kind of a cool thing. And then all of a sudden someone wants to go back to make sure that Uncle Ralph knows that they're okay. And everybody's sad because that person's going to be ill again. You forfeit your memory, you know, that kind of thing. So really, death is the way out in terms of what we would normally associate with a word called ascension. And I'm going to suggest that it's possible for you to do that without having to die, where God so favored you, you know, you didn't have to go through the death to, you know, move on to the next place, having consciousness. That is what we call the evolution of consciousness. And time is a duration of a consciousness, which means it's not really real. It's how you store memories. And so if you have a way of beginning to work on yourself, what you're doing essentially is catching up with past lives, of picking up from where you left off on your purpose. And I have had the rare opportunity, when I was at the Nexus conference in Australia, last year I met this man that had a near-death experience. He died, came back, left with a bunch of impressions of what's going to happen next. You know, the light, like Kubler-Ross.
Well, Richard, we're coming to break now. We'll be right back. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Richard Allen Miller is my guest. Don't you go anywhere, folks. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the most operatic 2 hours in talk radio. It's automatic, it's operatic, it's systematic, it's Grease Lightning. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. And my very special guest is Dr. Richard Allen Miller. Now, you were talking just before the break about somebody who had a near-death experience. Could you recap that, please?
Well, the guy died and came back to life, and when he came back, he was left with some impressions that, you know, follow a lot of the tracks of, you know, the light at the end of the tunnel, relatives there to greet you, blah, blah, blah. And he said some interesting things. One thing he said was, everyone you meet, you're going to have to live their life as part of the whole big picture before you get out of here. Now, that suggests that none of this is real, and that you're having to, everyone that you meet, me, you, whatever, have to experience our lives as one thing that you do. That each of us has something important to do that has to happen before we, all of us, get out of here. And that means that if you don't get off the couch and you don't do it today, that's okay. You just keep coming back until you do get off the couch. And that's one of the reasons why the bloodlines of Christ were so interesting. They kept epigenetics and the relationship of genealogy and bloodlines to remember your past and your purpose and why you were here in the first place. And then once you regathered some of your memory of who you were in the past, you pick up from where you left off. This is metaphor. You pick up where you left off and finish your project before you get to move on. And he said that everyone that you meet, then you should pretend like they're you, and you treat them like you would treat if it was yourself that you're meeting. And I found his concepts valid in helping me assimilate my own understanding of what changing the movie might really imply, literally. Now, I'm trying to do it as a physicist. And so it's got to have a physical analog to it, you know what I mean? Not transhumanism where I place my consciousness into a computer, you know, but somehow there is a relationship of continuity to what I'm doing. And I have recently discovered that for myself. I'm old and smell bad, and so I'm rotting and getting old, and now I'm getting it sort of kind of. And what I'll try to do is leave a few footprints on terms of how you might want to do it through your voice and your little pipes that you're talking about, little pipes of pan.
You've kind of faded out there a little bit. Can't hear you.
Oh, I did. I don't hear you coughing.
Because I was murdered.
Oh, you were murdered. Yeah. I love your accent, by the way. It's just very charming. No,
you're welcome. All right. Now, elements. Death. I was just thinking about this. Do people fear death? Yes, they do, in a large extent. You know, somebody's got a gun on you, and he's trying to rob you, and if you don't give up your money and all that kind of stuff. Most people will have the Shiite Muslim scared out of them, right?
Now, well, I was just thinking about this. Survival circuit, that's one of the neurologic circuits.
Yeah. Well, I was just thinking that must exist for a very reason, because a lot of people who say that, you know, and you yourself have said that this isn't real. This is a hologram and that kind of thing. What I've figured out is, like, I play a bit of video games here and there. If you pretend that the video game is real, you play much better at it because you're playing for keeps.
There you go. In other words, you go into a timeless place called the flow. And that's what Crowley called doing your true will. You know, basically where you're not in conflict with anything. And then, you know, reality wants you to do that. And most of us do it emotionally, kicking and screaming. And we create what's called karma, like a pinball going back and forth against the wall, you know, ricocheting back as you're going down the track. And the idea is to take, like a sports car, we find the flow of the move so that you're not in conflict with anything. In fact, that would be the definition of a saint, is someone that's not in conflict with anything. Mm. And so, well, that's one of the measures I did. Is Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh a saint? I don't think so. He's got machine guns and his neighbors are trying to, you know, that doesn't sound like a very saintly thing going on there, even yeah. though he's religious. Well, you know, the idea of doing your true will, the way Crowley would put it, is none will say nay. It's what you're supposed to be doing. And so James Hillman wrote about that. It's in a book called The Soul's Code, In Search of Character and Calling. And basically, you have two elements. You know, you got your purpose here, your calling. You have your character, little nooks and crannies that life has laid on you for why you're, you know, dysfunctional in this way and not that way, that kind of thing. Right. And so character, that's, you know, how you choose to go down there kicking and screaming or stoically or whatever you do. And what I'm trying to do now is discover the path of least resistance, the way of tapping in to your purpose. That'll be one of the chapters in the non-local mind. Besides ascension, another one will be purpose. You know, man doesn't really have free will. Basically, to have free will, you'd have to have total disclosure. You don't. What you have is true will. You know what you know up to a certain level, and that's all you have to work with in terms of trying to complete your purpose.
See, I just assumed that I'm probably wrong. In so doing, I'm always right. Because I'm wrong on occasion, which means that I'm correct. And if I'm not wrong, then I'm right.
I played those logic games, yeah. I wouldn't have seen it if I hadn't believed it. You know, yeah. Number 8 flat iron skillet works pretty good.
Yeah.
Altered.
Now, we were talking about, you talked about a saint as somebody who's never in conflict with anybody. I was just thinking about the only two types of people in the world. Those people who want to be left alone and the people who just won't leave you alone.
Oh, yeah. Well, my dad said it differently. He said there's three ways of being in this world. There's the vulgar, the adept, and the exempt. And the vulgar get audited, the adept gets money back from the government, and the exempt has a 501c3. They don't pay taxes.
Yeah,
in other
yeah.
words, you get a free get-out-of-jail card when you're exempt. That's why the Masons place it so high. It's Adeptus Exemptus, grade 7 in the temple. You know, master of the temple, that means you create your own universe. Magic.
Of course. I've always thought about that philosophy, and it's like, if I can create my own universe, does that mean 7 billion other people who also can create their own universe avoided whenever I create mine? That doesn't sound logical to me.
No,
but crazy.
But consensus is the largest mob out there.
Yeah.
That's how that works. You know, the power of the group is greater than the sum of individual parts. That's why you go out into the universe as a solitary before you start working with tribes. Find your own center before you start working on other people. You know, God, I think it's, how does it go? We are no longer at war in the physical world. That if we want to change this world, we change ourselves and the world changes with us. That's the way it's going to work, one step at a time.
Yeah, well, I think it's about morality. And it was funny, I was watching a presentation by Mark Passio from whatonearthishappening.com. I'll be having him on in December. And he was talking about morality is actually the search for truth. Because if your morals dictate that you are to tell the truth, then morality itself is, in fact, truth. And lies are inherently amoral. Right? And I was just thinking...
You could talk about internal landscape, the secondary level of that. And the internal landscape of being honest, for example, is that I'm afraid of being busted or I want to do the right thing. And, you know, they're different, and yet they're the same. And what happens is the one that's afraid creates an internal landscape that becomes true. That is how you structure water, how psyche is brought into matter, is done usually through the structuring of water in your belief systems. You know, that's how the brain works. It's not a thinking thing. It's to make what you believe true.
Well, of course, if somebody was to shoot me from 300 yards with a high-powered rifle and I believe that the bullet wouldn't blow my head off, it'd still blow my head off regardless of my belief. Because what I found is the danger is mixing up the importance of the physical reality and the spiritual reality. You know, like I feel that the physical and the metaphysical are just as important, and without acknowledging the existence and the importance of both, it's kind of like an unbalanced hemisphere in the brain. Sort of like, so you know how some people are like too right-brained and some people are too left-brained. You know, they don't believe anything even if they see it. and the other side of the brain only believes things if they see it, and they're both wrong because you need your whole brain freaking working.
Well, you've got the yin and the yang. You've got the balance of ration and reason, and voice of coyote and voice of reason. You know, you have, and it turns out it's the same way too. By the way, stepping outside the box. That's why, you know, when you're not sure what you're doing, you're always got some doubt. You have this, you know, nervousness.
Yeah. All right. Well, Dr. Richard Allen Miller, thank you very much for coming on the show today. It's been an honor and a pleasure and various other nice adjectives too.
Cheers. I'll give you a website if people are interested in knowing more about where to get my books.
Go for your life, son.
You bet.
All right. RichardAllenMiller.com was one I saw on the...
I have this one here. It's OAK-publishing.
Oak-publishing.com.
Yeah.
Oak-publishing.com, ladies and gentlemen, and we will see you again sometime. Thank you, Richard.
Yeah, but...